Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of About Abroad, where it's my job to introduce you to people who have built amazing lives for themselves in various foreign corners of the globe. We're talking with expats and thought leaders about moving abroad, remote work, visas, and all the fun and practical knowledge that you need to know to follow in their footsteps. If you've ever dreamed of making a life for yourself overseas, maybe working remotely or embracing long-term travel, retiring or studying abroad, or even just taking a peek inside life beyond your borders, you've landed in the right place. This episode is brought to you by my friends over at Make My Move. Many of you are already aware that there are places around the world that want to attract remote workers to come and live there. But did you know that some of them will actually pay you to do so? Yeah, that's right. And aside from the cash incentives these towns might offer you, there are other incredible benefits ranging from free babysitting to concert tickets and even free healthcare. These places also make a terrific home base for digital nomads with super fast internet, friendly neighbors, and affordability in close proximity to major airports. In fact, the remote workers who relocate typically save around $20,000 per year by moving to these new communities. But perhaps most importantly, the locals in those communities are truly excited to welcome new movers in and get them plugged into the local network. The problem is, where do you start? But luckily, Make My Move is your one-stop shop for all things related to these towns. Since 2021, they've helped more than 1,000 remote workers and their families relocate, and through their platform, you can explore all the places that are offering incentives to come and live there, get personalized help to find the place that's right for you, connect with the locals, super important, and access support services to actually make the move a reality. Take advantage of all the benefits that come with your location independence by checking out makemymove.com via the link in the show notes. My guest today is Rolf Potts. He is the author behind Vagabonding, one of the leading travel books of our time, as well as his latest creation, The Vagabond's Way, which is just released and is absolutely worth a read or listen as well, alongside a host of other articles and books and his podcast, Deviate. He's one of the OGs of the travel game and someone that I've been following for over 20 years, I believe now. So it was absolutely awesome to have him on the show. I love his work. I love the way that he thinks about travel and explores the world and how he's perpetuated that through his life in different phases and chapters of his life. It was a lot of fun to pick his brain. I really, really enjoyed this one, and I think you will as well. Please help me in welcoming Rolf to About Abroad. Yeah, so I have to tell you, like, kind of a funny story. I was thinking back as we were getting ready for this interview. I read Vagabonding right after my first trip abroad, first time I ever left the U.S., and just before I was getting ready to go study abroad, which was going to be like my first big immersion into the world of travel, and ended up being both of those ended up being life-changing experiences. But reading Vagabonding totally changed my perspective on what travel could be. Like, up until that point, I thought, like, I probably have a couple years of this in me, and then I have to settle into the real world. And it totally changed my perspective. And so I imagine you probably hear things like this from time to time. But I guess I kind of wanted to, like, kickstart this thing by saying, thank you in a way and acknowledging that, because it truly was one of those big time game changing books for me. And it's awesome to have you here on the show. I'm super excited for the conversation today.
Yeah, glad to be talking about this. And after 20 years, Vagabonding is 20 years old this year. I still love talking about it. So,
well, that dates me a little bit. I guess we're talking about 20 years ago, man. It came out in 2003. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be exactly right. So I read it right after it came out.
No kidding.
That's wild.
Huh.
Yeah.
And it's funny that it's an old book. It's a very well-known book, but people, like young people, will still read it and say, basically, I'm not getting this message in other places,
mm-hmm.
that sort of, you don't have to, you can slow down, you can spend less money, you can spend more time. That's sort of been internalized in the travel conversation, but through Instagram and all the other ways that people are talking about travel, there's just less of this quiet, giving yourself permission to travel conversation that is more important, it feels like, than the sort of the flashier look at me conversations that can surround travel. So,
yeah, it's sort of been idealized in a different way now. I gathered that, there was a big difference between reading The Vagabond's Way and vagabonding is that a lot's changed. In 2003, those things didn't exist. You know, we didn't have social media really, and there certainly wasn't this like Instagram culture of just like glorifying every single picture. And you can really see that all of that has changed quite a bit. But when you read both books.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be people would complain, purists would complain about glossy magazines. Oh, things are too pretty. Things look too perfect in Condé Nast Traveler magazine. Well, now everybody has the option to be Condé Nast Traveler magazine, and the algorithm likes clean, idealized pictures of what travel is like. And that's fine. It's good to celebrate the better. In fact, if you look at my own Instagram feed, it's probably everything is about 40% prettier and more perfect than it was in real life. But I think that creates an expectation sometimes that bewilders people when they get on the road and they found out that, yeah, a day can be hard, right? A hard day can be good, you know? And no, you don't need to race to the next Instagram photo spot. You can just enjoy where you are, and where you are is probably better than the Instagram photo spot. So I love it that this conversation is still happening and that people are still finding permission to go quiet and travel humbly when they read my first book. And then, yeah, you know, The Vagabond's Way, my new book, is sort of an answer to that. That folds in a lot of issues that have arisen since then, although it draws on wisdom that goes back 3,000 years as well.
Yeah, that's what's so cool about it, is that you tap into people who have been world travelers, the ones that we know of, the Marco Polos of the world and all the others, and kind of pulling wisdom from way back into antiquity into today's world and kind of meshing it all together. And I mean, that was one of the things that really jumped out to me, was like, I feel like anybody, wherever they are on their vagabonding journey, whether they're just getting started or seasoned travelers, could probably find something, something to tap into there.
Yeah, no, I think there's just so much that's relatable. I mentioned that the Japanese poet Basho, who lived hundreds of years ago, he walked across the north of Japan, and he has this great little haiku about having to sleep in a shed, and there's a horse pissing by his head, and there's fleas all over the place. And it's like, yeah, travel has always been kind of hard, and that's part of the joy of travel. I think that Basho hundreds of years ago was frustrated, but that was part of the journey too. That's what made it satisfying. And so one fun thing about folding all of this centuries of travel into The Vagabond's Way is that we're sort of in conversation with one another. And that's fun. You know, we have a lot more tools as travelers these days, but the core travel experience is just as challenging and rewarding and life-affecting as it ever was.
Yeah, it really is. And so speaking of which, I mean, I guess I'll set a little bit of context for anybody listening. You're currently calling in from back home in Kansas, correct?
Correct. Yeah. No, I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, which is about an hour and a half south of where I live now. And yeah, my home base is in Kansas. And, you know, sort of in digital nomads communities, Kansas is not the big destination where people go. But it's worked really well for me. And I can talk more about that if you're curious. But I'm close to my family. It doesn't cost much, you know. And I met my wife here. I met my wife on my deck just a couple feet away from me. At the beginning of the pandemic. And so it's funny that as counterintuitive as a place like Kansas has been, I have no regrets. And, you know, a great thing about living in an inexpensive place that's close to family is that I can also travel a lot during the year. And collectively, my family, we can sort of watch each other's possessions when we're gone.
Do you guys, do you actually get to travel a lot still? Or like, what's the cadence like?
Yeah, well, it depends on a given year. And of course, the pandemic threw everything into a spiral, but I guess the pandemic is mostly over. And so like last year, 2022 was the first year that I actually did serious international travel since the pandemic began. And so, yeah, it's an option. I guess it's like any other digital nomad hub where I just sort of have strategies in place where I can travel. I don't travel like the same dirtbag I was 20 years ago, where I'm like traveling on $4 a day and going really, really cheap. But my wife has family cabin in Colorado, go there. I go out to Oregon, just went out to Oregon last month. And then last summer I went to Paris, where I teach a writing class each summer, and then to Norway, where my wife has family, and then to the Faroe Islands. And so, yeah, travel, I think I'll never travel in the same intense way that I did when I wrote Vagabonding. But it's part of my life's conversation. There's no separation really between travel and home, and home for me is Kansas.
Yeah, we kind of like weave that. People that are living this lifestyle in perpetuity just kind of weave in and out of it. I think it doesn't always have to be this like same. We don't have to maintain the same cadence. I don't know if you feel this like, or at any point in your life you felt this, but I certainly have kind of gone from full-time nomading to being kind of present in one place. I mean, I've lived in Spain in pretty much the exact same place for the last 5 years, and sometimes felt like weird about that. Like I needed to keep up this pace to keep getting this fix or something. But at the same time, I felt really comfortable just being home. I've moved back and forth to the US a couple times and moved away again. And each time it's like, it's just a different chapter in the book, I guess. It's, but there is this kind of internal need to try to keep up with yourself from your previous days. And I've had to like push that down a little bit. I don't know if that resonates at all, but I've certainly felt that.
Yeah. Well, there's this, especially with younger travelers, there can be this weird competitiveness, you know,
yeah.
That like one of the first questions in a group of young travelers is always, how long have you been traveling? Right. And so the silverback is the dude who's been on the road for 3 years, and the person who's been on the road for 3 weeks gets less respect in that group just because they know less. And I get that, but I sort of got tired after a time of, you know, people sort of bragging about how little money they'd spent in this already super cheap country. And so I think over the course, your travel career deepens and matures in a certain sense. And so I just had less of a desire to keep up with that competitive aspect of dirtbag travel. And it was really satisfying to come back, you know, all the way back to my unsexy part of America and get some property and spend some time with family. And that's, I've said this before, but it's a lesson I learned from travel. You go almost anywhere in the world and family is really important to people. And so living close to my parents and my sister and her family has been a huge part of the last decade and a half that I've been based out of this part of Kansas. Yet I have the flexibility to travel. And I think, I guess speaking only for myself, it might be a little sad if I was still traveling in the super dirtbag way I was 20 years ago. You know, if I was still, you know, saving every penny and traveling out of a backpack, that was perfect, you know, in my 20s, in my early 30s. But I think I sort of had to mature into a broader sense of who I was. So I think over time, and this comes up in my new book, The Vagabond's Way, that travel really becomes a conversation with home. I think there's this 20th century idea that your vacation was sort of this separate thing. It was like a product that you bought, and then you eat, rest, and you have fun, and you take photos. Where now, what I'm doing is very, very common with millions of people, I think, where travel itself is in conversation, and I might spend weeks or months overseas or on the road in a given year, but a home is still very much home, and it doesn't compromise home, and it doesn't compromise travel. So it's a fun period in history to be alive, because travel is safer and easier and more accessible. And you can literally have a long conversation with your mom, you know, while you're in Namibia, and then go back to your travels. So it's been fun.
My dad loves to do this. My dad's a pilot and has been his entire career. He's nearing retirement now, but he's been a world traveler. By default, pretty much his whole life, and certainly my whole life. And over that period of time, it's become so much easier when he's overseas and now I'm overseas, like for us to just have a quick WhatsApp phone call or something, or a video call even. And he absolutely loves this. Like he'll be out walking the dog back in Florida. And I'm over here in Germany right now, and I'll be walking down the street, walking my dog. He's walking down the street, walking his dog, and we're doing a video call over WhatsApp. And man, how cool is this? You know, this radio signal just bouncing off some satellite. I hear you instantaneously. You're on that side of the world. I'm here. And, but it's so true. It gives you this, it makes it very, very easy to keep those relationships, to have that sense of home, even when you're abroad. And there's part of me that's like, that I love that. And I appreciate that. And there's also part of me sometimes that misses a little bit of like some of the friction that used to be there. Like I remember on, you know, the flip side of that, like sitting in phone booths, trying to buy like, calling cards and, you know, connect back home. And, you know, there were times when, of course, that was even considered luxurious. So I don't know. There's a dichotomy there, I guess, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that really dates you. A phone card. Yeah. I think there's young people who are just like, why on earth would you use a phone card? No, but that was like when I was early in my backpacker days, early in my vagabonding days, late 90s, early aughts. The generation before me sort of saw my generation as decadent and depraved because we had credit cards and calling cards and dial-up internet, which they didn't have. Like, if you were backpacking through Asia in the 70s, your mom got like 2 postcards a month. And and unless you arranged for poste de restante at a post office, you never heard from your mom at all, except when you like waited half a day in a post office in India to pay an insane amount of money to call your mom and talk to her for 10 minutes. And so yeah, I think that I think there's just so many ways that travel is easier, and there's fewer excuses not to do it if it's something you want to do.
Yeah, you talked about this in the Vagabonds Way, actually, how like there's this I never thought about it before, but it made so much sense, like how there's this inherent need for people to romanticize the previous generation's way of living. And I guess that's also very true, just in the sense of like when we think about what it used to be like, the old days. and so I thought that was really good.
Yeah, there was around this time, there was a New York Times article that basically said, travel is dead. The dial-up internet, oh my gosh, this is science fiction. Travel is dead. And it's just like, yeah, I think that people just reflexively idealize, you know, the travel world as it existed when they were 20, you know. And then you get a little bit older and it seems like, and I'll admit that sometimes I'm just like, I'll see young travelers and it's just like, oh, please put down your phone. This is such a great moment. But I'm sure 20 years hence, they'll find something that younger travelers are doing that irritates them. So yeah, it's part of this very long travel conversation. And the upside of this moment in that conversation is just that it's so comparatively easy, regardless of how you romanticize previous generations of travel. Yeah, it's so easy these days to get out and do it.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, like a big portion of the audience here on About Abroad comes from sort of the digital nomad remote work era. You know, a lot of people write in saying like, I've just gotten access to location independence. My job's gone remote. You know, now I can go do a 3-month workcation somewhere, or I can just go full time on the road, or I can move abroad. But I kind of don't know where to start. You know, that's a fairly common narrative. And so I think it's, you know, it's really interesting talking to someone like you who was really pioneering the nomad space before digital was attached to that digital nomad phrase that we throw around so often now. So I don't know, like, do you mentioned earlier, like young people still read Vagabonding and get a lot from it. And I can see why, it's sort of timeless in that way. Do you, like, what do you say to those people when you get a similar narrative coming your way? Like, I've just gotten access to this, like, Rolf, what would you suggest I do with all this freedom now? And I want to go hit the road. Now I can do it. What would you do?
Well, I would say slow down, because I think sometimes people, and now it's easier than ever to have a giant menu, a giant bucket list of what you want to do. And I think, especially for young people, just remember you have plenty of time. You know, there's no reason to pack 10 countries into a month. You know, that's actually cheating yourself out of the experiences that await there. And then also sometimes in the digital nomad space specifically, it's funny how, I mean, digital nomadism technically existed when vagabonding came out, but it's something that picked up in the late aughts and in the teens. And so, you know, vagabonding was sort of grandfathered in as this sort of textbook for digital nomadism. But one thing I talk about in the Vagabond's Way is don't just go straight to the digital nomad hub in the Yucatan or Tbilisi or Bogota, or it's Medellin where a lot of digital nomads go. Travel first, you know, find out, just because, you know, there's a lot of guys who sort of have the same career and interests as you and they live in this hub on the other side of the world. Find out what you love first, you know, because I wrote Vagabonding in this little town called Renang, Thailand. Will never be a digital nomad hub, but it was cool. I got to know it in an organic way, and I wasn't in a bubble of Americans when I was there. Nothing against hanging out with other Americans when you're abroad, but I really encourage people to just go slow. And before they put down roots in one place, just find out what part of the world appeals to them. I think one cliche is that, actually it's not even a cliche. I tell people to not micromanage their plans, because they might fall in love with the place and want to stay longer. Often they'll fall in love with like the third place they visit. And then by the time they get to the sixth place, it's like 10 times better than the third place. And that's one fun, unpredictable part of travel, is that you know, of course, place number three is going to be great. But then the more you get to know it, just the smarter you get as a traveler. And if you allow yourself to go slow and just sort of leave options open, then you can go back to a place that really spoke to you, a place where you can live an affordable life and sort of go up a level in social class because it just costs less there. And that's part of the fun. And so that's my main advice for young travelers. And I remember being this way when I was young, of just trying to stuff it in, thinking my life was ending, you know, that my youth was ending and I needed to do everything at once. And it's like, no, I'm in my 50s now. I still feel like I'm in my 20s some days. So just take your time and keep your eyes open and be willing to make mistakes and good things will follow.
Do you actually have some of those places on your list that like that you've landed on that you've said like, you know, I could go back. I really want to go back and spend more time there, or I could see myself, you know, spending like significant portion of the rest of the years that I have there. Or do you just kind of like to perpetually keep exploring new places?
It's a little bit of both. And one funny thing is that I got married not too long ago and my wife has deep travel experience in Europe. And I have deep travel experience in Asia. So part of the fun of going back to places in Asia will be taking my wife there, you know, like showing her Thailand, where I basically lived while I was writing Vagabond, and going, taking her to Korea, which was such an important part of my travel career when I was an English teacher there. And then having her take me trekking through the Alps, which she's done a ton of times, or she went to drama school in London. And so just hanging out in her old favorite parts of London. And so I think this is an ongoing thing. Like I said, last year, we went to the Faroe Islands, which was brand new for both of us and was just amazing and super memorable. But then we went to Norway, where she's known cousins her whole life. And it was just really fun to just be with her family and sort of see these people who are not Americans, but love my wife in a way that predates me, you know. And so that's another fun thing about travel. I think some people might fall in love with a place. It sounds like you really loved Spain. Germany really is a place that you respond to. And so there's no one way of doing things. You know, some people fall in love with a place, they marry somebody from that place, they raise a family there, and that's that. Other people are more like me, where I have a strong affection for the place I came from. I can live very affordably there, and I can continue to revisit old places and discover new places as I go. It's a great part of being alive at this point in history.
Yeah, there's something really cool about revisiting places through a different lens, like at a different stage in your life or with a new, like a significant other, or perhaps like a group of friends or something. I had that opportunity last year. You mentioned like the Alps and stuff. So I've spent a lot of time in that area, and that's been one of those places where I just could continuously return to, you know, like I'm in love with the Alpine villages and the charming, you know, European towns and railway system and all of that. And I had the chance to take my parents there last year and like show them some of my favorite places that I visited throughout the years living in Europe. And it was just so cool. Like it was a whole new experience. Like when I was in college, I went like skydiving there in Interlaken, Switzerland. And there I am like 15 years later showing my parents this same little town. Totally different experience, you know, like hanging out with your parents versus like living in a hostel and vagabonding around. But there were two of like the most special experiences at the same time and just happened to be in the same place. And so I'm personally really enjoying this phase of life, revisiting some places that I really, really love and really connected with, but just experiencing them in a different way.
Totally. I have a direct parallel there. I went to China, Mongolia with my cousin. We were both dirtbagging it years ago. And then years later, I took my parents there. And it was this strange reversal where I was the parent and I was showing them around and keeping them safe and making sure they were fed and stuff. And it was just, to this day, it's been a long time ago that I took my parents to China, Mongolia. It's still a treasured experience. You know, if we, in a spare moment, we can always talk about that and get excited about that experience we had together. And actually, I'd love to take my wife to those places too. And so I think that those, you know, Heraclitus said that you never step in the same river twice because it's a different river and you're a different man. And that's true that we, as we get older, as our experience of ourselves and the world deepens, then you can go back and see a place you thought you knew with new eyes. And that's fun. There's some places, I teach a class in Paris every summer. So I've been for years I've been going back, and actually it was funny. It was the first time I took my wife with me to Paris for my classes, and she's a big foodie and a big wine aficionado. And I realized just how much of a slob I've always been in Paris. You know, it's a well-reputed food city, but I was always sort of the lower middle class rung of that food ladder. Whereas she, who has a very good palate and a very good sense for things, it's like, oh my gosh, my wife, who has only been here once and then for 2 days, is showing me and things in Paris that I've never seen before, and I've been here a ton of times. So it's a fun thing to happen.
You guys sound like a match made in heaven, like just the yin and the yang. Like, you both love to adventure and travel, obviously, but you've seen and experienced a lot of different sides of the world, and you can kind of balance each other out in that way, show each other some new things and experiences. That's got to be pretty exciting. It's a fairly new marriage, correct?
Yeah.
Last couple of years?
Yeah. We got married 2 years ago. We've known each other for three, which is weird. I was like a bachelor forever. This probably happens in digital nomad communities. Yeah. is that people just they're single for a long time. You know, they're a moving target is tough to pin down. So it was fun that during the pandemic, you know, I met Kiki, my wife, and you know, like 5 minutes into the first date, I knew that this was my person, which is fun. And then yeah, we do have that yin yang thing. We share a lot of things in common, like Kansas. She's a Kansas girl. And then our love of walking. She's probably a better hiker than me. But then also she's an Asia person. She likes the finer things in life in a way where I'm a dirtbag adjacent now, who knows about Asia. And so we get to share a lot of stuff in a way that's fun. And it's a great second or third chapter where I can just sort of turn a page and suddenly everything is new in a way I hadn't expected. And I think I often tell people if they get a little burned out on traveling, it's like, well, come home or try something different. Shift up a little bit. Get hungry to get back out on the road again. And so just because I have this new partnership in my life, I feel like I'm experiencing places in an exciting new way that I had no idea. I wrote the vagabonding book. You know, what was I supposed to learn by the time I was in my 40s and 50s? But now it's just this new level of excitement because I've stayed open to letting that happen. It's been fun.
That's so funny though. You mentioned like you met her off your back deck, I think you said, or something. So like I'm presuming, without going too deep into your personal life, I'm just presuming you guys lived near each other. Or, I mean, had to be in the same vicinity or something, right?
Yeah. Well, it's funny how we met on a dating app.
Okay.
And we never would have met. Like we figured out that we've been in London and New York at the same time over the last, you know, 15 years. But we just, and then actually we grew up about an hour away from each other in Kansas, but we never would have met without this silly little app on our phone. So it was during the pandemic and we matched. And I think, you know, we both really weren't looking for, we didn't think we would find, because we were in our 40s, we didn't think we were looking for people in Kansas. And so she thought maybe she would, it was just during the pandemic. What else are you going to do? You're going to kill some time on a dating app. You know, chatting with people you'll never meet.
For a vagabunder, you know, you couldn't go anywhere.
Exactly. And so literally we had such an immediate chemistry through texting that she was on a trip and our first two dates were socially distanced. We didn't even touch or high five. We just sat outside and talked, and it was Victorian in a way because I lived near my parents and she had been living in Europe. She was back in her hometown near her parents. And so our first two dates, our parents were present in two different locations on our first dates. And so it's sort of this charmed experience that came out of the pandemic, and it was just immediate chemistry. And I feel really lucky to have been able to do that. And she's a Kansas girl, but she's a traveler. And so it feels like I'm early in this chapter of my new travel life where I can travel with the woman I love and discover new things with her, yeah. Even though some things may be not new for me or not new for her, they're new for both of us together. And that's fun.
Yeah, that creates a whole new dynamic. And I think it can be some of the most exciting times, especially when you know, like there is also something I think kind of comfortable. I don't know if this is necessarily true for everyone. Maybe it lacks some of the adventure that some of us might crave. But there's also something really comforting about being able to revisit places that you already know you like, and you know that you're just going to show up and enjoy it, or you kind of know the ins and outs, where to go. And I think that could get mundane for someone who really does crave adventure. But when you're doing it with someone else for the first time, it adds that adventure back in. It reintroduces that ingredient. And so for me, that's been a really fun part about this time in life, is is going back to places that I know I really enjoy already and I kind of know what I'm doing. I'm still going to discover new stuff and get that thirst quenched, but at the same time, I'm doing it with someone new and that makes it fun again.
Yeah, and you can dig a little deeper. I think sometimes when you first go to a place, you go to the obvious places because you should. Paris, go to the Eiffel Tower, of course. Go to the Notre Dame. You're not going to avoid them just because there's a lot of tourists there. But then when you're in Paris for the 10th or 20th time, then you can have just a much more subtle time and you sort of know the lay of the land. And it just makes sense. And I talk about this in The Vagabond's Way. There's this dichotomy of tourists and travelers. There's this idea. And then, you know, basically a lot of cities, tourist districts are designed to accommodate travelers. And so there's sort of this surface level thing that you experience the first time you go to a place, which doesn't mean you can't have an amazing time there and have original experiences. But then the more you go to a place, the more it feels like it's in conversation with your life. And pretty soon you're doing things that you just couldn't have done the first time you went there. Suddenly you're not in the first arrondissement of Paris, you're in the 20th and you're hanging out at this African fusion restaurant and just enjoying the city in a way that it never would have occurred to you the first time. And in a way, it's made more complex our relationship with places because it used to be this was your home and this was the place you visited. Well, now we have different places that sort of feel like home, you know. I'm sure that there's parts of Spain and now Germany that feel like home to you, even as North Carolina feels, you know, even more like home. And that's a privilege of being alive at this point in history, is that we can be all over the world and sort of take little parts and make them part of our own self and feel comfortable in many parts of the world.
That is 100% nail on the head for me. And it's a privilege. And also, like, I would be curious to get your opinion on this if you ever feel any element of it. Is I feel a bit guilty sometimes because I find myself being absent from one place or the other. So, like, for example, all my family's back in the US. I'm over here. I've been living in Spain for 5 years, but now I've been in Germany for 6 months. I am privileged enough to live my dream, which includes a lot of travel and such. But then I also find myself, like, literally just yesterday, my wife and I were talking for hours. Like, we were sitting in this beautiful European town that we love and we're having a great time, but we were kind of lamenting missing home, missing friends, missing out on something, you know, some family events, things like that. Should we be moving back? And we spent like an entire day on this subject. And I found myself thinking, like, I'm kind of disappointed. You know, I kind of feel guilty because I'm wasting this moment here. And then I try to talk myself out of that because I think, well, no, it's just a natural thing. But this privilege to have this flexibility and ability to live in a lot of different places, call a lot of places home, comes with those things. And nobody's going to feel sorry for you probably, but I think it's a reality that a lot of people face. So, I don't know. I found it's almost like a sense of FOMO or something. I can't quite put my finger on it, but it's definitely a reality.
Well, it's a good thing to feel. Those conversations are good to have because I don't think any travel experience that's too smooth-edged is probably means you're missing something. And so I think, part of any community is giving back and mentoring people and being in conversation with people who might not have the privilege of being as mobile as you. And so I think one ongoing thing, for example, here in Kansas is my wife and I are people who are sort of witnesses to the rest of the world, you know, that we can sort of talk about the subtleties of places that you don't always see in the news headlines. And then we can also be in conversation with people who are grounded here. I mean, and then even when we're living overseas or traveling overseas, those conversations are important because, again, we're tempted to do this in the Instagram era, that travel is sort of a look at me exercise, you know, look what I'm doing, but you're not. But those conversations, like you were talking with your wife about, talking about, ooh, should we be doing more? Are we shortchanging our family? Those are good to have. Even if you don't come up with a solid answer, it just reminds you that you belong to other places as well. And again, it's pretty historically unique to be this spread out. And so it's good to remember that anything that is too look at me perfect might be at the expense of certain give back aspects of the communities that you're a part of. And so it's good to think about.
Yeah, it is. I think it's like a healthy thing to go through, and it's okay to admit I there is something about this Instagram-y culture that just kind of perpetuates this idea that everything's supposed to be perfect and glamorized and you show all your highlights, and it can sometimes feel like awkward almost to share some of the downsides or realities of life. And I think a lot of us want that to change. I definitely gathered that from The Vagabond's Way, like you, that, you know, you were inching people towards that, like, just consider this a little bit as you're traveling. But I don't know how that changes. You know, I don't know what's going to click with people to start showing like the Instagram versus reality, more of the reality. but I'm not losing sleep over this personally. I mean, I don't think you spend a ton of your energy on, you know, glamorizing your social media either. And so I feel like it's just like, you know, where you go about your way, you enjoy your life, share what you can, inspire who you can. And, but in the meantime, like, don't try to over glamorize it.
Well, I think one aspect of the social media travel experience is it usually centers the traveler and in the lens. And so one thing I talk about a lot in The Vagabond's Way is, you're in the world, you know, other people are part of you, there's a host culture involved. And sometimes that host culture is not the wearing the traditional costume that you thought that they would be wearing. It's people who are kind of cool and, you know, might be wearing jeans and using smartphones, but they're just as African or Asian as the other people who look more traditional. And so I think, even metaphorically, not that everybody is literally traveling like the way they do in their Instagram, but metaphorically, if you can sort of realize that it's not about you, it's not about centering the traveler, but realizing that you're in conversation with this place. And if it's always about your metaphorical perfect abs on the beach, then you're going to miss what you can learn from these host cultures, because lots of times there's an exchange that's hard to capture on venues like Instagram that's very central to travel. And so if you're not aware of and open to that exchange, then you're not going to be traveling in the same engaged way that you could be.
We'll be right back to the show after a quick break for a note from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by my good friends over at Greenback Tax, the very best in U.S. expat tax services and the company that I've trusted to handle my tax situation since I moved abroad in 2015. Greenback is 100% focused on helping U.S. expats with their taxes, and to date, they've filed almost 50,000 returns for nearly 15,000 happy customers like me living in more than 200 different countries around the world. After 7 years working together, I can say with confidence that they make one of the most painful parts of life abroad an absolute breeze with their automated systems that store all of your information for you to make tax filing easy year after year, and the friendly advisors who you actually have a working relationship with. There are no robots over at Greenback. Best of all, everyone is a CPA or enrolled agent with a specialty in U.S. expat taxes, which means they know exactly how to help you take advantage of some incredible tax breaks because you're living abroad, not in spite of it. As of January 23rd, tax season has officially arrived, so it's time to get started. Learn more about Greenback Tax today by visiting GreenbackTaxServices.com via the link in the show notes. Hey guys, if you're still around and enjoying this episode, then I think you might like my buddy Matt Bowles' podcast as well. He hosts The Maverick Show, and he's also a former guest here on About Abroad, telling very similar stories, bringing in people from around the world that he meets on his travels as he runs his location-independent business from various foreign corners of the world. If you guys are enjoying About Abroad, I'm pretty sure you'll like his show, so go over to the show notes, check it out, and give it a listen. I think you'll like it. You mentioned the trip to Faroe Islands, and something you either posted about or maybe shared in another interview. You like to go to like children's books, like read children's books and go to libraries and things like that. Is that correct?
Actually, it's schools.
Schools, okay.
My parents are teachers. I've done a lot of teaching over the course of my life, and I found that in any country where English is not the first language, every school has an English teacher. You know, another thing we're historically privileged that the second language program in local high school is not Swahili or Russian or some indigenous language from South America. It's English. And so it's like walking in and I'm an expert because I was born in America. And so because I taught English overseas, I have pretty good instincts for these classes. And so I've had really fun experiences just sort of introducing myself to the village English teacher, talking to the students for a while, and then meeting these awesome students who know enough English to be really charming and sort of you know, especially in smaller villages, they've never met an American before. And so then I get to see the world through these teen, or see their village through teenage eyes. And it's really fun. It's something that I've enjoyed in almost every continent in the world.
Wow, man, that's, I just love how those little, those dots can connect, right? Just by like dipping your toe into something that is sort of off the beaten track. It's not necessarily something that people are going to like go do every time they go to wherever, you know, whatever place that may be in the world, in this case, Faroe Islands. But like the dots connect and create this incredible situation and experience. And I think that's the kind of thing that I'm seeking a little bit more of, is like those unique experiences where you get deep into the culture, get to hang out with people who aren't necessarily mingling with tourists all day, every day. And you know, get to put some of your skills to use also as an English teacher.
Yeah, and I think sometimes we forget that the local people we meet in tourist zones are cool, but they meet 500 tourists a day. You know, they don't really have much bandwidth for us. And if they do, you know, project friendship, it usually ends up in their uncle's carpet shop trying to sell us something. And that's nothing against them. They're just playing the numbers game in a tourist zone. Whereas if you own a little village or some neighborhood that isn't part of a tourist zone, then suddenly you're putting yourself in a position to meet someone who's actually interested in you. And that's when you have these fun experiences that you can't really put in a tourist guidebook, because it's like, yeah, I spoke to an English class and I went to the neighborhood restaurant and then we went to this little music festival that I didn't know about. And then I was invited to a volleyball game and I was taller than everybody, but I got completely destroyed because they were better at volleyball than me. And then suddenly you have this experience that you could never have predicted when you're sitting back home, but it's just such a rich part of your day or month or year, because you just were hanging out with people that you didn't know existed, you know, the day before.
Did the volleyball thing actually happen, or was that just a metaphor?
It happened. And I write about this in my second book, and Marco Polo Didn't Go There, about, it was in Cambodia actually. And I'm like super tall. I'm 6'3". So in Cambodia, there's not many 6'3" people, and they typically are quite a bit shorter. And they saw me in this village. This is a long story, but they pulled me in because I looked like I would be a good ringer. And then within 5 minutes, they're like, dude, just please get off the court because this is not helping our team. And it was humiliating at the time, but it's a great story because it's not like that they kicked me out of the village. We all had beer afterwards and we continued to do things. I was just a bad ringer. And, you know, again, that's not in the guidebook. That's not usually on Instagram. It's just something that happened because I made myself vulnerable to other people in this little town, this little village in Cambodia.
I had a eerily similar, like almost to a T, similar situation. Do you know the China Daily in China? It's like the
English language.
Yeah. It's like the English media outlet in China. I did an internship there in college, and same exact thing. Like I'm not 6'3", but I'm fairly big, especially when you're walking through the office in Beijing and somebody said, hey, you want to come play football with us, soccer with us after work on Tuesday or whatever. And I thought like, oh, I don't play. I've never played in my life, but yeah, sure. That sounds like a nice way to meet people. I'm picturing like some guys kicking the ball around, you know, in a small group or something. And I show up and it's like a full on game, like China Daily versus like, you know, Bank of China or whatever. And full jerseys, referees, like it's a legit match. And they put me in there and I'm trying to tell them like, no, I literally don't know what I'm doing. I've never played a day in my life. And they thought I was being humble. Like they just thought like, right. Oh, you're just, you know, you look like you know what you're doing. Go ahead. And I think they just thought like maybe I was like European. Like in retrospect, I'm like, did you just think I was like, I grew up in Europe and I had to have played right. football. But anyway, I went out there within 3 minutes. They were like, oh yeah, no, you really don't know what you're doing. and yanked me back out. And then they tried to put me on the basketball team. I was equally as useless. So
I think there's something endearing about being incompetent though. Like people feel bad for you, or they just think it's funny. You know, and like in Cambodia, they just thought it was hilarious that this big tall guy was completely useless on the volleyball court. And I'd played volleyball, not competitively, but I knew that how the game was played, but they just thought it was hilarious that I was not good at all. And again, it was way more interesting than if I had just gone to Angkor Wat or whatever the other A-level tourist experiences are. Again, not to knock the basic tourist experience, but it was far more memorable to get my ass handed to me in volleyball than it was to wait in line and look at the ancient Khmer civilization at Angkor Wat. So.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, you end up making, you know, real, like, true friends through that, or at least spending a couple evenings together, hanging out, like, living like locals in a way. And it is very endearing. You're right. That's a good word to put on it. Talking about, like, the kind of, like, tourists, not traps, but, you know, the typical sites, you know, if you're in Cambodia, you're going to see Angkor Wat. Or if you mentioned Paris, like, if you're in Paris, of course, go see the Eiffel Tower. How do you at this stage in your, you know, vagabonding career balance that? When you go to a new place, like, do you have the energy to go see those sites, or has it lost some of the luster along the way? And what do you, like, seek out when you're in a new place now?
Well, a little bit of both. I think that it would be silly to be such a travel snob that you don't go to the obvious places when you go to a city. But at the same time, there's sort of a sameness to some tourist zones. Like, you could be waiting in line, you know, at a famous monument in Egypt or Sri Lanka or Peru, and there's something, a little sameness to it. You'll appreciate this because you're in Germany. There's always some German there in, like, a quick dry clothing. Germans are everywhere. They're in all of those lines. Nothing against Germans, but it's just, you could meet the same dude from Dusseldorf in Peru or Sri Lanka or Egypt, you know. And that's fine, but that is you're only halfway into that country, that you're basically in this tourist bubble. And so I've always become a big fan of just sort of walking around. I call it, in both books, I call it Walk Till Your Day Becomes Interesting, in Vagabonding and the Vagabond's Way. But basically, and Egypt is a great example. I love Cairo, and Cairo has a very, very specific tourist attractions, but you just walk a few minutes in any direction off the tourist trail, and somebody's going to take an interest in you and invite you in for tea or want to talk about the NBA or whatever. And it's funny how, like, American sports and movies capture people's interests all over the world. Yeah. So it's sort of a subtle thing. I've realized the limitations of going to the most obvious travel thing. And so it's ended up being sort of a combination of all things. Maybe I start doing something obvious and then find ways to do things that are less obvious.
Makes sense. Yeah, it sounds like a good balance. Is your wife up for the same type of travel as you? Like, there's still a bit of dirt bagging sprinkled in there, it sounds like. So she on board?
Yeah, yeah. And we actually, you know, she researches her restaurants in Paris that she wants to eat at and ones that are recommended and stuff. And I've always sort of been a walk until your day becomes interesting guy. So our compromise, which worked great, was that we didn't get data plans for our phones. And then once she figured out what restaurants she wanted to go to, we put them on with pencil on a paper map, and we used that paper map to get around Paris. And it was fun, you know, because then we weren't looking at our phone. We were trying to figure out how to get around using a paper map. It was like we were in the ancient era of 1997 all over again. Like, paper maps was how people got around. So I would imagine our travel, since our collective travel experiences are fairly new, we're still sort of getting used to how each other travels, but it's been really fun so far. She's seeing things that she doesn't normally see, and I'm seeing things that I don't normally see. And in the case of Norway, like, I've been around the world, but I've never traveled with a travel companion who has family in another country who's known them their whole life and loves them. So when we were in Norway with her cousins, it was just so fun to have this new experience and the funny thing about that is that they sort of lived in provincial Norway. They like lived in the Kansas of Norway. Actually, there is no Kansas of Norway because Norway is just stunningly beautiful everywhere. You know, the beauty in Kansas is subtle, but we were in a provincial part of the place of the country, and they were showing us these places that they loved and that they wanted to show off from their part of Norway that aren't really on the Instagram feeds or in the guidebooks. And so it was just a total blast to see Norway through the eyes of these people who loved my wife and had loved her since she was 2 years old. And so it was fun to experience that for the first time just last year, almost 20 years after writing Vagabonding.
That's wild to still be, to be able to say that you're still getting, I don't know if adrenaline hit is the right phrase. Maybe it sounds too hyperbolic, but, like, in a way it's just gotta be very cool. And I think exciting for people who are maybe earlier in their, you know, vagabonding career to see, like, you're still getting a ton of excitement and enthusiasm out of these experiences. And that doesn't seem to have faded much over time.
No. And I hope it never does. And I suspect it never will, you know?
Yeah.
Again,
it's
ingrained. By the time you get burnout, by the time you get jaded, well, that's a red flag of sorts. And it's time to go back and rest a little bit and get hungry for travel again and put yourself in a position where you allow yourself to be surprised. Because this is something that happens in digital nomad communities sometimes, in these little compounds that you have in other places. You end up working 60 hours a week like you would back home. You end up sort of being depressed for reasons you don't understand. Well, it's because you aren't really away from your home. You've created your own workaholic bubble in a place that is sexier than your home back home. And so that's times when it's like, well, maybe you should go walk through a neighborhood of this distant place that you've never walked through before that isn't where the digital nomad compound is. And not to knock digital nomad compounds, but it's just like, if you're feeling burnt out or jaded as a traveler, just think, well, what am I doing too much? What can I change up? How can I surprise myself? How can I leave myself open to serendipity and be a little bit uncomfortable, but a lot surprised?
Yeah, I'm actually really, really curious to hear your opinion on this. Like, was there, when you were like first getting started in your vagabonding days and, you know, just before writing the actual book, like, was there an equivalent of what we see today with some of these like digital nomad hubs? Like, were there, you know, was it just a smaller microcosm of that in terms of like youth hostels and thing, or is it just on a totally different scale now? Or do you see it as like, you know, pretty much the same?
It's different. I don't know. Maybe it's different in part because there's a word for it, right? Digital nomad.
Yeah.
At the time, it was just expatriates. Like when I was writing Vagabonding in the town called Renang, there was like three foreigners that I saw a fair amount. There was an American couple who lived pretty close to me, and there's this Italian dude named Max who lived on the other side of town. But they were just sort of expats. There wasn't, and because it was the dial-up internet, it's not like they were. Doing business back home. They were living their lives and doing business in Thailand. And so I guess if there's one thing that people have always lived overseas, and in fact, like when Marco Polo went across Asia, he was always running into Europeans. We see him as this pioneer of travel. It's like, no, he met Europeans were everywhere. They just didn't write about it back then. When the hippie trail was going across Asia, there was the hippies riding the magic bus. But there's Americans and English people in all parts of Asia as well. It's just that they were being there in a quieter way. And so I think what has happened, especially with the rise of digital culture, is that it's just easier to be aware of each other and easier to be aware of this expatriate, for lack of a better word, community worldwide. And now these communities are talking with each other, and they're talking to their boss in Cincinnati or Dallas or Boise, right? So it's like technology has been able to amplify what was always there. And now we have a catchphrase with this name, digital nomadism. And it's a good thing. But again, I think the worst cliches to happen is that the ease of digital nomad life can put you in a position where you only have one foot away from home. Well, all mm-hmm. your habits may as well be in Cincinnati, Boise, or Dallas, because you're still sort of chatting with the same people and watching the same media and not really making yourself vulnerable to this new place that you've traveled so far to see.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like it's been commoditized in a way, which I think is cool because it opens up the doors for lots of people to have these experiences. And like my timeline is a little interesting because I think I'm like one of the people that was just getting started in travel before digital nomading was like really a thing. Like, I mean, it wasn't, I tried to present the idea that I could perhaps take my online job, which was already remote, overseas. And it was like, no way, man, you're way ahead of your time. And this is like, you know, 2009, 2010. And then all of a sudden, like pretty quickly, I mean, especially through the explosion of remote work and the pandemic, it becomes commoditized in a way like overnight, and there's digital nomad visas everywhere. And so I think like I'm happy for the people that have access to this because that's what I really, really wanted early on in my like career. I wanted to be able to like have a job that I liked and that I could earn a decent income, but also not have to sacrifice that just to be able to explore a little bit. And so it makes me really happy. But then at the same time, I'm like, Well, when you go abroad and you go to these places now and you don't get to actually experience the culture, or people choose not to experience the local culture, but instead just kind of hang out with a big group of people that look and sound exactly like them, I feel like, oh, are we wasting it a little bit? Like that would be a shame to have come all this way and then not get the real rich experience. So there's some kind of balance that has to be struck there. And I know a lot of travelers want to find that balance, and maybe a lot haven't had the chance to realize that yet, or haven't thought about it yet, but it'll be interesting, I think, to see how this like plays out over time.
Yeah. I think these conversations are going to have to keep happening. You know, anybody whose life seems too smooth-edged might not really be vulnerable to the place where they are. You know, they're trying to live up to their Instagram feed rather than really engage in the place they are. I'm gonna reach over real quick because I have something to show you.
Please.
It. Yeah, it's right here. It's funny that you were talking about digital nomad visas. When I lived in Thailand, I had to cross the border every 30 days. So my old passport is just full of the same stamp. I mean, it has a lot of different stamps in it. But like this is the passport from that era. I'm not sure if I can find it now that I've said that. But it's just chock full. One, it's super thick because I kept having to put more pages into it. But I would cross the same border station again and again. And so the whole thing is just full of the same stamp. Myanmar, Thailand. Because there wasn't a digital nomad visa, but the hack at the time was just crossing the border once a month. And in fact, I've forgotten about this. Part of the reason I was living in Renang, Thailand, as opposed to Chiang Mai or some sexier part of the country, was that it's a border town. Like I could be in Myanmar and be back in at my desk and continue writing Vagabonding in half a day, right? So I forgot about that. Like had there been digital nomad visas in 2001 when I was writing Vagabonding, I may have lived in a different part of Thailand, but because there wasn't, I lived in this border town, which of course I don't regret. But so it's funny. I wonder, that did not exist, and now it's just easier. Again, I'm tempted to be the old guy shaking his fist, get off my lawn. It's easier it's easier for you young guys. But one fun thing is that I have this ridiculously thick passport, in part because it has all these Myanmar Thailand stamps in it.
That thing is awesome. I guess you're going to hold on to that. That's a relic right there. I would definitely want to show that off to the kids. You know, look at this thing. This is what I used to have to do.
Exactly.
I actually, it's funny you mentioned that. I literally just a week or two ago met a couple I actually knew the couple already, but they told me this story that they were living in Thailand. I think it was in Chiang Mai. And for years, and they were doing there was some form of border hopping, but it was like they had much longer. Their visa allowed them to like be there for 6 months and then they had to leave for a little bit and then come back. And but it was sort of a gray area. Like it wasn't like completely legal, but it was like everybody kind of does this. They actually got put in jail. They spent like the border guards like just caught a immigration officer on a bad day. And they said like, no, this is technically illegal and put them in jail. And it had to do something with like, you're supposed to be carrying a certain amount of cash technically, and they weren't. And so anyway, they told me like, yeah, next time, like we got to go for digital nomad visas now because we were just border hopping for forever. And that, I guess that won't work for us anymore.
Yeah. I think sometimes too, in parts of the world where border guards are not very well compensated, there's sort of a bribery economy. I'm not suggesting this is what's happened, but I've seen it before where basically they may have missed the nonverbal cue to slip a 20 in their passport, and that would have kept them out of jail. I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but I think sometimes as middle-class Americans, we forget these different economies that in India or in, you know, Argentina, that middle-class people are just sort of used to slipping an extra few dollars in certain situations, in bureaucratic situations, that we don't have to in the United States. And so it's part of that ragged edged experience of travel. I've met people who just become infuriated they had to bribe somebody because by American standards, that's corruption. But in some parts of the world, it's not fun, but it's just like, yeah, that dude makes, you know, $5 a day. So you just you just made his day by giving him a 10, right? So
Yeah. I think you'll be okay. And as you said, make someone's day in the process. That's
I'm not saying that happened to your friends, but it could have been My instinct is that a $20 bill could have kept them out of jail.
I think you're exactly right. Yeah, I think that was the implication for sure. It just wasn't. That's what they were saying. They were like, we just didn't really understand. Like, they were asking us if we had money, and we were like, no. We like, what? Why do we need money? And then it was just like, boom, we're in jail. Mm. You're like, man. So anyway, kind of an interesting aside there. I wanted to ask you something. So I mentioned earlier that Vagabonding was a very special book for me at a special time in life. Another one of those books that came around the same time that was also really important for me was The 4-Hour Work Week by a friend of yours, Tim Ferriss. And I was listening to the episode that you did on his podcast a couple months ago, and he just briefly dropped this in there, or maybe you did, talking about this random day that you got, oh, we were just, remember that time we were hanging out in Paris? We got to do that again sometime. And it triggered in my mind as we were about to talk today, like, I'm trying to imagine what a Tim Ferriss and a Rolf Potts would do in Paris on a random Tuesday or something like that. Is that a true story? You guys just like met up in Paris and were hanging out?
Yeah, around the time he was putting together tools for Titans, he came into Paris. He was a student in my Paris class for a while.
Wow. And
I said, Tim, we should walk to Versailles. So we walked from the Notre Dame to Versailles. I forget how long it took. It took like half a day or something. And it was cool that we just had this long conversation that lasted 4 or 5 hours. And it was cool. It was a very memorable day. It was sort of a walk until your day becomes interesting, but very, well, it's flaneuring. There's something very special. I talk about it in The Vagabond's Way about going someplace on foot. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't hung out with Tim a lot over the years. I've hung out with him several times, but we might never match our hang time during this long walk. We just covered a lot of ground in our conversation, and there's something about this. It's like a side-by-side companionship rather than face-by-face companionship. Your conversation just goes into interesting directions when two or more people are sharing an activity like walking. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a really memorable time, and we were tired by the time we got to Versailles, but it was a good way to spend half a day in Paris.
That's amazing, man. What a cool way to spend a day there. I actually, interestingly enough, had one of my few like true solo travel experiences in Paris, and spent the whole day or the whole like several days I was there on my first trip there, walking all by myself, and thoroughly enjoy. It was like a eye-opening experience. It's just interesting because it also happens to be in Paris, but I had always been big on, you know, biking around or going to see the sights and using public transportation or whatever. But for some reason, Paris was just like, I have like 4 days by myself to kill. I'm just going to just walk this thing and, you know, go to the Louvre by myself. And it was a very, very eye-opening thing. But there was, as you mentioned, there was something special about the walking aspect.
Yeah, I think any city in the world can reward walking, but Paris is just a walker's paradise. I mean, just really not even just sort of with a vague idea. Oh, yeah, the Louvre is here someplace. The Eiffel Tower is right there. You know, I know Hemingway lived around here someplace. And then you start walking. And I have yet to find a city in the world. New York is close, but Paris is super special as just sort of a walk until your day becomes interesting city. Because it's so beautiful, and there's just so much to stumble into in that place.
Yeah, there absolutely is. Well, I know I've got to get you out of here pretty soon, so I just want to thank you so much for your time. We mentioned Paris quite a bit, and I know you have an upcoming course being taught there, so I would love if you'd mention that just in case anybody's interested. I imagine people are, but also if there's anywhere else that people should follow along. Learn more about you and your work, buy the books, please feel free to mention those now, and we'll get those in the show notes as well.
Yeah, well, I'm an old school website guy. I've had my RolfPotts.com website since 1998, so I think this is like the 25th anniversary of my website. And it connects to everything, all my social media, like years of stories, and it's just a good place to start. It connects to all my books, all my podcasts, my Deviate podcast, although, you know, you can just Google or put Rolf Potts into the search on your podcast platform and find my podcast Deviate. And then, yeah, my Paris class is something that happens every year. I'm teaching 3 1-week classes this year. Two of them are sold out already. So if you have August 7th to 11th free, that has some slots left. I always welcome students to that class. And it's always just such a blast. It's a fun way to interact with people and fellow travelers in the city of Paris. You can go to pariswritingworkshops.com to find out more about that class. But you could also just go to rolfpotts.com and go to classes, and you can find it there as well. Yeah, put Rolf Potts into Google and you'll find all sorts of interesting stuff, because my career has been long at this point.
Yeah, you won't be short on information if you drop that in the Google machine. So yeah, Rolf, thank you so much. I know you're busy, and there's a lot going on over there. So really appreciate you taking the time. This was a blast for me, and wish you lots of success going forward.
Yeah, same to you, man. Good luck in the ongoing journey.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon. Thanks for tuning in today from wherever you are in the world. Once again, I'm Chase, and this has been another episode of About Abroad. For those of you wondering how you can best support the show, I have made it super simple for you. Just go over to the show notes of the episode that you just finished listening to and click on one of the two following links. aboutabroad.com/newsletter to get our monthly newsletter, no spam, guaranteed. Or ratethispodcast.com/aboutabroad, where you can quickly and easily leave a review for the show. It's not just important to me, it also helps more wanderers just like you find us. Finally, don't forget to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice, and we will see you again next week. Thanks again. Hasta luego, amigos.